Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
Hey, True Crime Cast fans, Jamie here. We're joined by Pete Early today for an interview about his book, No Human Contact. Pete is a New York Times bestselling author, was a journalist for the Washington Post, was a Pulitzer finalist. Very honored to talk to him today. So just wanted to give him a bigger introduction before we lead into the interview and enjoy our conversation of Pete and his fascinating stories of being in prison for a year, just to report on it. We are joined today by Pete Early, a Pulitzer finalist, a mental health advocate, a Washington Post journalist, New York Times bestselling author. Pete, I am just thrilled to be able to talk to you today. Thanks for joining True Crime Cast.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on, Jamie.
Yeah, we're here today to talk specifically about your newest and I've heard final, kind of hope not, but final novel, yeah. No Human Contact. Which I mentioned before we went on the air, you started working on this technically back in the 1980s. How did this work get started and what led you to write it so many years later?
Well, thank you for asking me. So in 1987, I went to the head of the Bureau of Prisons. I was working at the Washington Post at the time, and I said, I really want to know how these people live day after day after day after day. What happens when you put all these sharks in one spot? And he said, oh, I'm tired of you journalists. You know, you show up when there's a riot, you show up when there's, you know, trouble, but you really don't understand the system. I said, I will spend a year inside a maximum security prison as a reporter. I'm not going to pretend to be a convict.
Right.
If, you know, you give me access. It's the only time they did it. They'll never do it again. But I literally signed a waiver saying, you know, that if I was taken hostage, tough luck for me. And that's it. I went in. I could go anytime I wanted. And all I hear about is, oh, this terrible Tom. Oh, this Silverstein. He'd murdered four people and he killed a correctional officer. And he's the most hated member by the BOP, and he's a member of the Aryan Brotherhood. And he's just awful.
Yeah.
And so I said, I want to see him. No one had seen him since 83 when he committed these murders. And this was in 87. And I said, well, I want to see him. And the director said, okay. Thinking I'd find this guy and realize what a danger he was, et cetera. So they took me down into the basement of Leavenworth. Now, before I went down there, they said, wear a clip-on tie because he'll reach through the bars and grab it and choke you. I mean, he's this vicious.
Yeah.
So I go down and we go in and it's like a dungeon. You go down under here and he's in this basement cell where there's absolutely no windows. The lights are on 24 hours a day. The cell only has cold water. He's totally isolated from everyone else. And there's a phone that the correctional officers use to call down there. And at night, they keep calling it to keep him awake. Like I said, the lights are on 24 hours. So I'm fully expecting that this guy is going to be some monster. And I go down there, and there's two cell doors, and they lock me in the cell right in front of him. Mm-hmm. And they leave. And this guy appears, and he hasn't shaven because he doesn't have a razor and all that. And he looks at me and he goes, you had to forgive me. I'm not used to talking to people. So sometimes my mind and words, he says, do you hear that? And I said, what? And it's the neon lights buzzing, the old neon lights. He said, welcome to my hell. This is my world.
Yeah.
So that led me to be real curious about what kind of person is this and why did he end up this way? And of course, he'd murdered three people, and one of them was turned back and by the courts, but it was too late. And then he murdered this correctional officer. Now, what happened was, at that time, there was no death penalty. for a federal crime, except for assassinating a president. And now he committed these murders. He was a member of the Aryan Brotherhood, the most feared white prison gang. And so the director of the Bureau of Prisons, Norm Carlson, said, how can I protect my people and also punish this guy so nobody does it again? So they came up with No Human Contact, the title of my book. And, you know, this is different than solitary confinement. Solitary confinement is you're locked in a cell block. Usually they're called the boxcars. They have a solid door in front of them, but you can hear other people. You can yell out in the tier. No. 10 months after he murdered Officer Klutz, he spent in a cell in Atlanta, completely isolated from the world. There was no newspapers, no TV, no radio. He was stripped to his boxer shorts in a cell the size of a king mattress. He could touch the ceiling and the walls, right? And no one would talk to him. There was no correspondence with the outworld. He was just alone. And that, I've never justified what he did, but that was just amazing to me. It was complete isolation from society as punishment to keep him from killing again. And I wondered, how do you survive that? You know?
Yeah.
And then he continued under that. It was interesting, Jamie, because they discovered that you can't control someone if you don't have anything to take away from them. In other words, they'd pass the meal tray into him and say, give it back. And he'd say, you know, F you, I'm not giving it back. Well, yeah. What are you going to do? You don't want to keep sending people in there and having fights, et cetera. So they discovered that if they gave him drawing materials or they gave him access to a TV, then they could get what they wanted out of him. And so that was what they used. They slowly lightened up. And one of the privileges he got was writing and once a month phone call. And after I met him, we remained in contact for 33 years.
Wow. How long had he been in this room without the drawing utensils, without the television, just completely alone himself?
For 10 months. I'm sorry, I'm going to mess your tape up. I have stage 4 lung cancer.
Right.
And luckily, it's in remission.
Praise
but
Lord.
I get these coughing spells, so I'm sorry.
No problem at all. It didn't pick it up.
He's in this cell for 10 months, completely alone, and he's about to lose his mind. And he listens to the only way he knows what time it is by the food. If it comes in the morning, he knows it's breakfast. At night, he knows, because the lights are on 24 hours a day, right?
Yeah, there's no way to tell what time it is ever.
Right.
Wow.
Right. And you have no idea what's going on in the outside world. No human contact. So he listens to the slot and he hears one of the correctional officers who's very religious. And so Silverstein very wisely says, when he opens up the slot, he says, will you pray with me? And the guy says, no, I'm not going to pray with you. And he says, will you pray with me? And he says, no, I won't. But every time he opens the slot, he says, please pray with me. So the guy doesn't pray with him, but he gives him a Bible. Now, Silverstein is nearly illiterate. Mm-hmm. He was on drugs. He had this horrible, horrible childhood. I mean, this is a guy who was beaten every day when he was little by his mother. When he was 5 years old, he had a bedwetting problem. So she beat him and made him drink his own urine to punish him. Mm-hmm. So he started on this path early on. I mean, just a horrific, horrific childhood. So he looked at the Bible, and that's actually how he learned to read and write. Mm. By reading the Bible. And it didn't mean he believed any of it, sure. And he didn't follow any of it, but he learned what the words were. And it was always kind of funny because sometimes you'd be talking to him and you'd hear this biblical word come out of his mouth and you go like, hey, this guy's a member of the Aryan Brotherhood. I mean, he'd slaughtered people. And, you know, it's just funny having him say a phrase like that.
Right. Yeah.
But he did that for 10 months. Actually, when he's in Atlanta under this no human contact, there's a riot. The Cubans from the Marietta Cubans riot in Atlanta and they turn him loose. Now, he always made a big point of this because they say, I'm such a cold-blooded killer. And I mean, he was. I mean, he was a shot caller for the Aryan Brotherhood. And my book, I described the various things he did in prison and murdering people. I mean, stabbing people over and over and over and over again. One time I asked him, I said, now you stab the correctional officer more than 40 times. Was there some, you know, is my Barbara Walters question, was there some kind of significance to that? He goes, Pete, I wanted him dead. I mean, it was,
right.
That was it. You know, it's pretty clear. But he always made a big point. He was free in the Atlanta penitentiary. The Bureau of Prisons were so alarmed about him being free, they gave a shoot on sight order. One of the only times that they ever done that. If you saw him, you're just supposed to shoot him and kill him. And he evaded that. But he had access to the officers that were held as hostages. And he always made a big point out, he never hurt him. He never did anything to him. He could have. Mm-hmm. And his point was back that he always claimed that Officer Klutz, Merrill Klutz, is the person he murdered. It was a personal thing. And it had gotten between the two of them. And that's why he ended up murdering Officer Klutz. He didn't want people to think he was just some wild-eyed killer. And in my book, when you go back his history, it's interesting because you can see in his thinking why he was justified in what he did. Not with Klutz. There's never an excuse for murdering an officer. But in the other murders he's committed, it was whites against blacks. And, you know, I didn't write this book until after he died, in part because I was helping him write his own story, and it wasn't publishable. So then I took it and I combined it with interviewing people who knew him and all that, and to tell the larger story about his life, what real prison is like, what it's like to be a gang member, and how he changed the system. It was odd because he and I were the same age. And he would remind me, one time he said, yeah, well, when you were 17, what were you doing? You know, I said, well, I was in high school and I was dating. He said, yeah, you're out trying to make out with some girl and, you know, and I was sitting in a cop car with a gun in my mouth because, you know, I'd stolen a case of beer and they were threatening me. I was getting beaten up. And he said, yeah, you spent a year in prison. You came and went, but you don't know what it's really like. He said, you know, I've been stripped naked, chained down on a concrete slab, naked, defecating, urinating on myself, having bugs run over my body and laying there for hours and hours. He said, that's the difference between our worlds. And so that was part of my fascination in looking at him and his life.
Well, this book does, it touches on the justice system, the way that we use incarceration in our country. It touches on mental health and personal development. I mean, even going into his childhood, like you and him parallel, like the paths you led. Where else could he have ended up from where he started, I think, is a fascinating question. And I've heard you talk about that on other interviews, but it's just fascinating to think about it in a human development perspective of what were those anchor points in his life. And was that solitary confinement one of those, or is that just kind of a result of the others? Just fascinating.
Yeah. You know, it's the old argument of nature or nurture.
Yeah.
With him, he had such a horrific, violent past, and it changed him. It skewed his moral fiber. You never gave up. If somebody came, it's the old, you know, Untouchables line. If somebody came with you with a knife, you came at them with a gun. You never, but he had this horrible relationship with his mother and his stepfather. people say, well, his name's Silverstein. How did he get in the Aryan Brotherhood, you know? And that was his stepfather's name who adopted him. But he was seen as kind of this class clown. And so he found out that violence works. I mean, he didn't know how to read, all that, but he knew that he was the toughest kid in the playground and people would respect him. So that reinforced it. He got involved in drugs early on. And then the crime that sent him to prison, he went through the juvenile system, et cetera. But the crime that sent him to prison was robbing banks with his birth father and his cousin. And they robbed these banks. Now, what's interesting about that story is that they robbed the banks. The FBI came to his mother, the one who had abused him all these years. She decides to turn him in for the reward. So she turned in her own son for the reward, which tells you something about the family dynamics.
Right.
Now, he enters the prison system. He enters San Quentin right at the middle of what was called the race wars. And there's a guy named Edward Bunker wrote a fascinating book, Life. He was in some Quentin Tarantino movies. He wrote a lot of, he was in prison at the time, and he wrote about the race wars where it didn't matter if you were a nice guy, bad guy. When the cells opened, if you were white and you were black, you were attacked. Yeah. And that was a carryover from the 60s black power movement and whites. And the interesting thing about the Aryan Brotherhood was the Mexican mafia and the Black Guerrilla family were the two biggest gangs. And they both counted on soldiers. They recruited. Mm-hmm. The Aryan Brotherhood realized early on that they would never have enough whites compared to the blacks and minorities in prisons. So that they decided they'd be the toughest, meanest group around. When actually in 87, when I went to the prison Leavenworth, people were afraid to even say the name Aryan Brotherhood. They were so notorious, there was absolutely no disrespect. And Tommy met a guy in San Quentin who introduced him to the gang. And then he got shipped off to Leavenworth. And his first conviction was for murdering a guy who was going to bring drugs in to the Aryan Brotherhood. And that later was overturned because it was proven that the officers involved in testifying against him had lied.
Right.
But that got him sent to the next level up. There are six levels of prisons. You know, if you or I get in trouble, we're going to go to a kiddie joint.
Right.
We're going to go to a club fed. We're going to spend our time playing Scrabble. I went to one once. It was pretty funny, Jamie, because they're playing Scrabble. And the one guy looks down and says, how many blank pieces are there? Because there's 12 on the thing. There's only like two, you know, but they're all cheating. But anyway, that's a whole different world.
That's great.
But, you know, he was sent to Marion. Marion was the replacement for Alcatraz, and it was a cesspool of the most violent. Mm-hmm. And he told me, he said, I got there, my life had been thrown away for a murder I didn't commit. Now, it's questionable whether that was true or not. But I decided that I was going to pay back society. And that's when he got into race wars with the group known as the DC Blacks, which were the predominant black group. And he and his partner initially strangled a guy. It's pretty interesting how they did this. It was a Sunday in Marion, and the guy is leaning with his head back against the cell bars watching TV, watching football. And they were out in recreation. And at that time, the Bureau of Prisons didn't realize it, but they allowed them to run the tier. And so these guys had a wire, and this guy's watching TV and whoosh,
wow.
And used it to groat and kill him. So that was a murder he committed. The next time around is an interesting story because this is Cadillac Smith, a guy from Washington, D.C., who is notorious. He murdered people in D.C. In front of witnesses. Nobody testified against him. Anyway, he ends up, he's the head of the D.C. Blacks, and he's loud, boisterous, and he's known as a prison rapist. Mm-hmm. He liked to punch people out and then rape them. Mm-hmm. And he gets put in the same cell unit as Silverstein. Now, this is where the Bureau of Prisons never gave me a good response as to why this happened. There are lots of institutions they could have put them in, but they put them in the same cell block, only a few cells away from each other. So Cadillac immediately comes on saying, I'm going to kill you, you white cracker. And he's going back and forth and back and forth. So Silverstein and Clay Fountain, who is his wannabe Aryan Brotherhood, who had murdered five people, by the way, they have to get out. By this time, they built a recreational cage in front of the cells because they learned from the guy they garroted that you can't let them just run up and down the cell block, sure. Right? Duh. So they create this recreation unit. These guys get a hacksaw blade, and I can tell you lots of prison stories about how you can get hacksaw blades and shivs and all this kind of stuff. And they use it night after night after night to cut through the wire, and then they put it back up. And right before they're going to move on this guy, they find Silverstein's shank outside. You don't keep them in your cell. You keep them outside because you don't want to get busted. Mm-hmm. That's why if you go to prison and they find a shank in someone's cell, they could be there because somebody's framing them. Or the guy could put it in his own cell because he owes a bunch of people money and he wants to get out of that prison.
Yep.
You never really know what's happening in these prison environments. So anyway, he'd lost one shank and a guy comes in, he starts pounding on the bars, a correctional officer, but he just misses by about a foot where they have this cut through, but pasted up there.
Yeah.
So Silverstein, they hear that Cadillac Smith's going to be taken down to do his shower. Now they've been watching Cadillac Smith. He has tried twice to kill them. And the officers have reported this. At one point he made a zip gun and tried to shoot Silverstein. Another time he tried to light him up. I mean, he's tried to kill these guys. So everybody knows they're at each other's throats. And Silverstein's in this environment where you're going to kill or be killed. I mean, that's the bottom line.
Yeah.
I fault the BOP for not keeping them apart. Anyway, Fountain is the first one through this, and they've been watching Cadillac Smith, and he always has a towel on his arm, and they know he has a shank there. Another foolish thing. The Bureau of Prisons at that time had towel racks in the cell. Now, a towel rack was a thin piece of metal and, you know, bolted on. Well, they bust those off and you got
of a course. Shiver. Yeah.
You wrap tape around it and you're ready to go, man. So they go running down. Fountain goes through first. He has a knife. And he runs at Cadillac Smith, and Silverstein's out. And Cadillac Smith turns and stabs Fountain, and he goes tumbling back. Now, Silverstein doesn't have a knife, but he is so pumped up. He hits Cadillac Smith, knocks him to the ground, takes his shank away from him, starts stabbing and stabbing and stabbing him. At one point, stabs him so hard, he's hitting the concrete floor underneath him.
Oh, wow.
Now, the officers are outside the bars watching this, but none of them are going to go in there and try to separate these two. People think, oh, you have guns. And in some state joints, like in California, they had piers where people had guns. But in the federal system, you just depended on all the officers to run there and overpower someone. At most, they could get a club, but they didn't have any guns or anything like that. Well, they're not going to go in there. So he kills him. Then he tries to cut off his head and drag him down the cell block in front of other black inmates to say, look, you know, don't mess with me.
Yeah, it's a message.
So they don't, at that point, they are, the correctional officers go, okay, now he's murdered three people. What are we going to do with him? And they claim they have nowhere else to send him. So Marion at this point is a tinderbox, because what they've done is they've taken the worst of the worst from every prison and put them there. So the Aryan Brotherhood actually is pretty much running the place. So they send in Merle Klutz, who's this veteran officer, who's a cowboy, a local guy. And he's old time BOP. He's not going to take crap from any inmate. And he and Silverstein start butting heads. Now, the real prisoners will tell you that there is absolutely no proof of what Silverstein claims. But Silverstein claims that he came in and he messed with his drawings, and he messed with his paintings, and he didn't let him out for mealtime on time and wouldn't give him his mail, regardless of whether he did any of that or not. In Silverstein's head, as soon as that guy hits the floor, gets on the cell block, he's like a caged animal. Other inmates tell him, don't hit an officer, man. Don't hit an officer. You'll never get out. They'll never let you out. The Birdman Alcatraz killed an officer and they never let him out.
Right.
So he decides to make the move. And so he gets his buddies in the Aryan Brotherhood to help him. And they take him out for shower. And because of the murder of Cadillac Smith, they have a new rule, another new rule caused by Silverstein. You had to have three officers with you. One, you're handcuffed, one on each side and one behind. So they have him stick his hands through the bar, they handcuff him, they take him out, they walk him down to the shower, takes his shower, and they're walking him back because one of them is klutz. Mm-hmm. Now, you're not supposed to stop in front of another cell, but he stops to talk to a guy. And the guy slips him a handcuff. He unlocks his handcuffs and lifts his shirt. Silverstein grabs a shank, turns around, says to two of the officers, "This isn't about you, it's Klutz." And Klutz is pinned back between him and the exit. And he goes, and Klutz has no defense. And Silverstein murders him. Mm-hmm. He stabs him more than 40 times. And you listen to Silverstein, and it's interesting because he says, you know, I just felt this relief. And then years later, because of no human contact, he deeply regrets it because he said, I threw my life away too. And he actually talks about how he dreamt about him and dreams about him. It comes in his dreams, which I have in the book. But that's when Norm Carlson says, oh my God, what are we going to do? You know, I'd like to put him to death, Norm says. He deserves to die. Because right after Klutz is murdered, Clayton Fountain, his buddy, attacks other officers because he heard that they were going to punish Silverstein, and he murders an officer. So you have two officers murdered on the same day in the same cell block, and they can't tolerate that. So they decide the no human contact. To his credit, Norm Carlson did not allow any kind of brutal, he didn't allow retaliation. And he got him out of there because he said, you know, Carlson was a former officer. And he said, yeah, I would have wanted to go in there and kill the guy.
Yeah.
So he got him out and he saved his life. But then he put him under this no human contact. What's interesting about that is that Carlson then goes to Congress and he says, look, we need better penitentiaries, and we need one that has so much isolation, these guys can't get to that, us or them. And that's where they came up with the idea of a supermax, mm-hmm. A penitentiary for the worst of the worst that you can rot in unless you follow the orders and change your life, and then you move down to a different level. And that's the U.S. penitentiary in Florence, Colorado. Mm-hmm. And it's set up so that you can move a prisoner remotely so you don't have to have contact with them. And that was their answer.
To Silverstein. That was their answer. He inspired this, right?
Essentially. Yeah, he did. And 44 states now have supermax penitentiaries. But he never did. You know, there's one or two other inmates who served a lot of time in solitary, but that is different. They went in and out. He got more and more privileges for his good behavior, but he always was kept isolated from other inmates, which made him unique and also made it interesting to me because how do you survive like that? I mean, how do you, you know, and early on, I decided it was pure hate. he was not going to break. You know, we talk about the power of love, and this is a guy who pure hate kept him going. And then later he mellowed because he got old.
Yeah.
But he really believed this whole mythical convict code, and this is how you carried yourself. And he took pride in never being broken and never giving in. And then, of course, he died from a health problem. But he was interesting. To me, it was an interesting study. He also, you know, we don't really understand prisons. The year, Jamie, I spent in Leavenworth was unbelievable. Like, I had an inmate tell me, he said, I knew you were weak when you walked in here and you didn't say a word. And I said, how do you know that? He said, you nodded at those black inmates. Now, why would a white person want to be friends with black inmates? It's because he's scared of them. I mean, that was the racism in prison.
Right.
And that was how easy it was to just pick up on those things. Wow. One of my best favorite stories, though, was I was sitting in the mess hall one day. I was talking to a guy, Carl Bowles. Now, he was a triple murderer. And he was a smaller guy, but nobody messed with him because he would kill you in a heartbeat without any problem. And he said to me, it's easy to identify a mouse. The trick is getting the mouse in the right hole. And I said, well, what does that mean? And he illustrated it by saying a guy came in. When you go into the Federal Bureau of Prisons back then, you had 2 weeks of orientation where they're trying to figure out, you know, get you used to being in the prison, give you your clothes, then you go to the cells, right? And they do a little psychological evaluation and blah, 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 blah. So a newbie comes in, a fish, and he's in his cell. He leaves, and someone goes in his cell and steals his clothes. Okay? Now you're in a prison, and someone has stolen your clothes. Well, what are they going to do with it?
Yeah.
So nothing happened for 2 weeks because the people who stole the clothes are called locker knockers, wanted to see if he was connected, because you can be a weak guy, someone to be preyed on, but you're maybe related to John Gotti. So, you know, what do you do? By the way, John Gotti hired the Aryan Brotherhood to protect him. But anyway.
Yeah.
So 2 weeks went by and nobody stepped up. So the guy wearing his clothes approaches him in the yard and says, hey, buddy, I heard somebody stole your clothes. And he goes, look, I want no trouble. Just leave me alone. Wrong answer.
Yeah.
So they're going back in the cell block and the guy pushes the guy down the stairs and says, you're going to pay me $50 a week or I'm going to kill you. Well, what's the guy do? He immediately runs the officers and says, oh, this guy's going to kill me. He's got a baby. So what happens? Well, they take him because they don't know if that's true or not. They ship him to a different prison and ship the guy who supposedly threatened him. So that's identifying a mouse. I mean, Carl said to me, go to a shopping center, sit down, look at who you'd mug. It's not hard. You're not going to attack somebody who's young and, you know, Mr. Atlas. You're going to attack or, you know, you're going to attack the little old man or little old lady. Anyway, so I said, well, what's the right way? And he pointed to a table. I'll never forget this. And he says, look over there. And there was this guy who kind of a medium built guy who with, you know, didn't look like a tough. And right next to him is this big old Hell's Angel type guy. And he says, that's his protector. He pays him to protect him. I said, really? He says, let me tell you what's behind that. So the Hell's Angel guy and the weaker guy are on the bus together. And the weaker guy is scared. And he mentions that his brother, he's in there. He was an accountant and embezzled a lot of money. And then there was rumors that he tried to kill the prosecutor. So, boom, got shipped to Leavenworth.
Yep.
So he mentions that his brother worked at Iowa Beef Processors. An executive. So the guy knows he has money. Mm-hmm. So the Hell's Angel guy goes to him during this 2-week period. He says, all I don't know anybody like you. I've never met anybody like you. What's it like, you know, and how are you feeling about prison? And he strikes up a friendly relationship. So the weak guy goes and he gets his clothes and he's walking to his cell. He goes in his cell and they're white and three black guys come in. You got to remember, this is a racist environment. White guys or black guys come in and bam, don't even talk to him. Start beating him, pulling down his pants. They're going to rape him. And the Hell's Angel guy comes by and goes, hey, wait a minute. That's my buddy. Get out of here. And they all go, oh, man, no, we didn't know. And so they leave. And so the guy goes, oh, thank you. Thank you. He says, you know, I can't put my life on this line for free, man. How about $50 a week and, you know, I'll protect you. So even if the weak guy is smart enough to know that the Hell's Angel guy set it up and he got the black guys to attack him, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
You can't. I mean, he could run and say, oh, these three black guys attacked me, which is only going to get you in deeper trouble. Or you can pay the $50 knowing that the Hell's Angel guy set you up. And that was the environment. Yeah. I mean, it was so weird, Jamie. I remember this guy telling me, you know, he says, when are most prison stabbings? I said, I don't know. He says, 4 o'clock. Why 4 o'clock? Well, that's when people get off work and come back to their cells. And he said, the doors are open. And he says, what do most people do at 4 o'clock in prison? I said, I don't know. Get ready for dinner. He says, no, they go to the bathroom. They've been working all day. He said, you walk down a cell block and watch and look in sometime. And you'll see the guys who really know what they're doing keep one leg out of their pants. Because if they're sitting on the commode and somebody comes in, they don't want to get up and fall over because their pants are all tangled. That's the kind of world you were in. That's the kind of world that Silverstein grew up in. And one of the things, look, if one of the things that reactions that people have when they read my book is they go, oh my Lord, how'd this guy survive in this isolation, right? And it's a good question. Mm-hmm. But you got to remember, since he was 8, 9, 10 years old, he's been in and out of institutions. Mm-hmm. You haven't, and I haven't. So the idea of being locked in a cell actually was pretty normal for him. Mm-hmm. And what you discovered, what I discovered when the year I spent in prison to write The Hot House and my dealings with Silverstein is there is a culture out there of people who this is their society. Mm-hmm. They don't do well outside of prison, but in prison, they're important people. And it's really the Aryan Brotherhood is their whole life in this in these institutions. You know, 85% of the people I met in prison just wanted to do their time and go home. 85% of the guard force just wanted to do their time and go home. But 15% on each side, you had the 15% Aryan Brotherhood, people in the gangs, people trying to bring in drugs, people trying to take advantage of other people. And then you had the 15% of the guards, the correction officers who wanted to be super cops who were hassling people.
Right.
One last thing, and then I'll stop on this. When you went to work at the Bureau of Prison in Leavenworth, the first thing they said to you was, never say yes to a convict. If a convict comes up to you, oh, and you'll find this interesting. So when I was with, I had to spend one day with the convicts and one with the correctional officers because they were so wary. I mean, if they saw me walking down a tier with a bunch of convicts laughing, the correctional officers would go, okay, what's going on? And vice versa. Mm-hmm. And God forbid, I'd go to a meeting and they're gonna go in a cell house tomorrow and they're gonna check for shanks. And the convicts go, oh, did he do this? Or vice versa. There's no shanks. Did, you know, so I had to be very careful. But even the language in prison was you had to be very careful. When I was with the convicts, you called them convicts, not, and when you were with the correctional officers, you called them correctional officers. Well, of course, the reverse was the convicts called them hacks, mm-hmm. and the correctional officers called them inmates, which they thought was, an insult. But now I forgot where I was going with that. I'm sorry. When I got off on a tangent, which I do. I was going to tell you more.
No, you started
about
off talking about the culture of the 15% that that they're not there to serve their time. That's who they are at that point, right?
Yeah, that's their life. Yeah, exactly. But there was a point on,
all good. And Pete, I could listen to you tell these stories all day. Just to clarify for my listeners, the no human contact wasn't established and they decided to put Silverstein in it. They created it for him, right?
That's correct. They created it for him and Fountain, who had a similar thing, because there was no federal death penalty.
Right.
And then, so the two things happened. One was they came up with a supermax penitentiary, and they designed these based off a Minnesota model, but they designed them like, I mean, how silly was it to have Cadillac Smith and Silverstein, you know, in the same cell block? You know, and how silly was it to let them have free range where they were running up down the cells and they choked this guy? Mm-hmm. And how silly was it then to have the rec cage there? So this design was designed where you could use remote control and modern devices to move a guy out of a cell, down a hallway, without even coming in contact with people.
Yeah.
The other thing that Norm Carlson did, which was really smart, was he used Silverstein and Fountain, and he went up on Capitol Hill and he said, look, these are animals, and you won't let us execute them. And Congress decided to change the law so that there was a federal death penalty. So you could be put to death if you attacked a correctional officer. So these two guys, who the public doesn't know anything about unless you're a crime buff, led to the supermaxes and also led to a return to the federal death penalty. Because before that, the only federal death penalty was if you tried to assassinate a president.
Right. How long was Fountain in the no human contact area?
He died younger. He did 19 years. And he was interesting, Jamie, because I said Silverstein loved hate. Did it by hate. You're not going to break me. Fountain became a monk.
Huh.
He got interested in religion. A woman wrote to him and said, you can be saved. And started teaching him and sending him stuff, and the church provided stuff. And he decided he'd become a born-again Christian. And right outside the prison, a few miles away from where he was kept, there was a monastery. And this monastery is very small. It only had like 12 people in it. But it was a monastery, a Trappist monastery, where you get up like at 4 a.m. and you pray, and you'd spend your day doing that. You don't do a lot of talking, and you pray and all that. And he, they learned about him, and he began following the traditional route that you need if you're a Catholic to enter the priesthood. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of, can we let him be a priest or whatever? And they finally decided that they'd let him become a monk. Let him become a monk, and he could wear a habit in a cell. And it was interesting because he was living a monastic life. He was just in bars.
Yeah.
Now, whether the two people who knew him best, one was he's still alive. He's in his 90s as a priest. And he was absolutely convinced that Clay Fountain was legitimate and he found Jesus and changed his life. The other one is a college professor who spent hours and hours and hours interviewing him over the years. And he was absolutely convinced that it was that he had not changed.
Yeah.
And of course the people in the Bureau of Prisons said, you know, we let this eye out. But what happened was, especially after my first book, The Hot House, was published, Silverstein and Fountain, The Hot House was a New York Times bestseller, and they became celebrities. I mean, people in the prison system knew about them, and women started writing them. People got interested in their cases. And this was a double-edged sword, because the prisoners made Silverstein kind of this Nordic god. So you couldn't put him back in general population, or could you put Fountain back in general population? Because they were at risk from other inmates saying, oh, I'm tougher than him, yeah, or I'll take him down. And especially the whole racial thing. So they really were, with their fame came, fame within the prison world, came this more reason to keep them isolated.
Yeah. Wow. That's fascinating. When you went into, well, two questions. What do you view kind of is the purpose of our prison system as it should be? And then having been there for a year, are we working toward that purpose? Or does it seem like there's something else that if you were just observing to say, oh, well, they're trying to do this with the system. Is it rehabilitation? Because it doesn't seem that way from my point of view, but I've never been there. Or is it punitive? Is it punishment? Is it, what are we doing in the prisons when you went there? And do you think it's changed now?
Man, Jamie, that's a great question, because that's, you watch Silverstein and you can see. So in the 60s, in the 1960s, the director of the Bureau of Prisons said that there was a medical model that could cure crime. If you gave a guy a good education, you gave him vocational skills, and you gave him therapy, you could actually rehabilitate someone. And you got to remember that most people go to prison, get out.
Yeah.
You know, but anyway, they actually believed this medical model cured people. So the RAND Corporation ended up doing this big study, and they found out that all it accomplished was that bank robbers knew how to write banknotes better.
Right.
It didn't decrease crime. So then Norman Carlson's view was, we operate a prison system. The punishment is isolation from society. We are not there to beat them, to make them suffer, you know, all this. And their attitude was that it was up to the convict. We'll provide the classes, but we have no responsibility for rehabilitating people. And in fact, it was kind of interesting, because how do you, if you're a young warden and you want to get ahead, how do you get ahead? Well, you get ahead by making sure that there's no stabbings and that people don't escape. Okay. Not rehabilitation.
Yeah.
Because you can't judge that. I mean, you know, somebody gets out in a year, are they rehabilitated? Anyway. So what happened was then under Carlson, they had really good food to keep people happy, and mm-hmm, also make them fat, because the joke was a fat warrior isn't a warrior.
Yeah.
And they had movie nights, which were hilarious, Jamie, because you'd go to a movie night and they'd show some movie and everybody's rooting for the wrong guy. I mean, they're all for Freddy Krueger, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, but the basic attitude was they have to do it on their own. Now, after Silverstein and Fountain, that changed and it became punitive. It became, we are going to punish you. That is what the Supermax is all about. We're going to punish you until you act and do well. Well, Jamie, I can't answer your question, because if you look at the history, it's the old thing about pickpockets at a hanging, picking people's pockets, knowing that they could be, and you look at Devil's Island, where the British basically sent people to Australia or Devil's Island to die. I mean, as cruel as they could be. And you don't know what's going to change a person. You know,
yeah,
you just don't know. Now, most of the guys I met in Leavenworth were just guys who got involved in drugs, who had horrible childhoods. Most of them were abused. But, you know, that by the same token, I interviewed correctional officers and they said, hey, my mom beat me with a 2x4, but I didn't kill anybody. So you had this, you just don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, you actually don't. I tell you one thing I learned that I thought was fascinating. There was a guy in prison who left his cell open. If you wanted to steal something from him, that's fine. He was barefoot. He took care of the cats. he wouldn't let anybody have sex with him, but he was, you know, I don't care. And this guy was going to get out, and they had a party for him where they made some booze and all this kind of stuff. And they invited me to the party, so I go to the party. And he says, Pete, he says, look, I'm going to make it this time. I'm in my 40s. I'm going to make it. I swear to you, I've learned my lesson. So I would go out for 28 days, then home for 28 days for my own sanity, because even as a visitor, when you go in these places, it really affects you.
Okay? Oh, yeah.
So I go home. He beats me back. He made it 10 days before he'd gotten drugs and robbed a bank. But the thing was, he honestly believed he was going to make it. Mm-hmm. But then when he got out, there was no support system. And so, you know, I can't give you the answer. I mean, correctional, it's kind of whatever the mood is across the country, whether we're going to torment people, beat them and show them the worst life, or we're going to try to help them and heal them this way. And the truth is, you look at Tom Silverstein, as awful as his childhood was, he met this girl, she got pregnant, they got married, he got the only legit job he'd ever had, which is construction. And he could have gone right then and changed his life. He had a good woman, he had a baby on the way, he had a construction job, and he just said, I want to be an outlaw. Yeah. I mean, his dad was an outlaw. He did not, you know, so when got in trouble, robbed a place. He liked that outlaw image.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's do most people, I mean, the recidivism rate for people in Leavenworth is about 60%, 65%. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some people make it, but they don't. The people who I feel the worst for, and don't in the federal system, I didn't see them, but in local jails and prisons are people with mental illness. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole nother book and another story.
Yeah, absolutely.
I can't answer your question because if I did, I'd get rich.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I could stop these people. But let me give you an example. So when I went to prison the first time, I thought, I'm going to go over to protective custody. Because I think a common thought among square Johns, which is what we are, mm-hmm. Is, oh, man, I'm just going to protective custody because I wouldn't want to get raped or abused or whatever. Mm-hmm. So there's 10 guys in protective custody, right? They're there because they're afraid of everybody else, right? Or they're snitches,
yeah,
which is a whole other thing that can happen.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So they all get drunk one Christmas, and the 10 of them force the weaker guy to have sex with them all. So even in this, you know, it's interesting. If you look at corrections, the Bureau of Prison thought, we take this 15% out, we move them to Marion, and we'll be fine. Well, you know what happened? A new 15% emerged.
Yep.
Because all of a sudden, you look around, you go, hey, they took out Silverstein. Now I'm the toughest guy. So what I'm going to start stealing and running drugs. So you never could get to, you know,
yeah,
regardless of what you did at that level, there was always somebody who'd fill that gap.
Wow. Yeah. That's fascinating. When I first started looking at what this book was about, I mean, the first word that came to mind was torture of having somebody, because I can't imagine that there is any positive mental health or physical health outcome to come out of this. Do you know of other prisons that have done anything like this? Do we only do this in for war criminals now? I know they developed the Supermax, but is no human contact a practice that you're aware of anywhere?
Yes. After Silverstein, now there's one guy in Florence who has been under no human contact status from day one. And he's under a SAM, a special administrative order, which means you cannot talk to him. And if his attorneys are there, someone has to be there monitoring the conversation. And that's Youssef, the guy who did the first World Trade Center bombs.
Yep.
And, you know, tried to bring down the, so he's there. But in a way, it's a, there's a just a turn of the knob difference between what Silverstein went through and what is being practiced at the U.S. Penitentiary in Florence. Mm-hmm. Because while you're in a cell block, the design is there's a steel door, then 2 or 3 feet in, there's a bars, and then there's the inmate. And so you can yell or you can talk through toilets. You flush the toilet and you yell down the toilet or mm-hmm. through the vents. But there's still a form of this isolation. Mm-hmm. By BOP, Bureau of Prisons policy, no one with a severe mental illness can be sent to Florence. Mm-hmm. But in my book, I describe how this really wonderful attorney out of Denver, Ed Arrow, A-R-O, went to Florence and he found dozens and dozens of people. And the depravity, you know, a prison not only affects the inmates, it affects the officers. Mm-hmm. And they had a guy who was severely mentally ill. He was eating his own feces. He wouldn't follow orders. You're supposed to get to the back of the cell right. or they when they sip a food tray through, and he wouldn't do that. So they wouldn't feed him. And so he became emaciated. He began eating his own feces. He began digging in his own flesh because he thought diamonds were in there. Rather than getting him any kind of help, the odor got so bad that they just put sandbags in front of his cell to keep the smell from coming out. But this is what, you know, when you treat people in the worst possible way, you're also demeaning yourself, mm-hmm. dehumanizing yourself. And what I found with is interesting about Silverstein. Now, Silverstein murdered Klutz in 83. So by 2000, 17, 18, 19, 20 years, let's say even 28 years later, all of the Bureau of Prisons has a mandatory, you had to retire at 55. All of the people who actually knew Silverstein were gone. Mm-hmm. And yet, every time he was moved somewhere, it was, oh, that Silverstein, he's an SOB. Oh, man, he's a piece of crap. We should kill him. They didn't even know him.
Yeah.
But it was the fact that he killed one of theirs and his blue bond and everything else, which is understandable. But what I mean is you lose your humanity and you don't think of these people as people. You know, Silverstein would kill you. I mean, he proved that. But he always had in his mind a reason to do it. And he loved people. He had a woman who he married in prison. He had developed, he became a fantastic artist. He had people on the outside who loved his art and tried. He was a, you know, he didn't have anything else to do. He had this amazing pen pal thing. People would send him money. He actually was sending the money to his wife, his prison wife. Mm-hmm. And he got up in the morning. He did his exercises. This guy would do 1,200 sit-ups, 1,200 push-ups, and 100 sit-ups, 100 push-ups. And he would basically start writing, then drawing for his own relaxation. I mean, he had an order to his life. Mm-hmm. There was one time when he was in Leavenworth that he seriously thought about killing himself. And he visualized it. And he was having nightmares about Klutz visiting him. But then that overpowering sense of, I will not be defeated. This is who I am now. I am a warrior. Mm-hmm. I am, you know, he had this whole Norris, and a lot of them in Aryan Brotherhood do, this Norris complex that we are the Vikings and you are, I mean, you know, in his view, we don't need police. We don't need any kind of folks like that. They're all bad. I protect the people I love around my campfire. And if you come into my campfire, I'm responsible, mm-hmm. you know. And what they leave out of that is, if that's the way it is, I'm going to come over to your campfire and take everything you have.
Right. It's not all protect our own. It's
guys are, they're serious, man. I mean,
yeah. Did you ever find yourself in physical danger while you were there?
Well, yeah, it's kind of funny. So I'm roaming around. Everybody knows who I am. I mean, there are no secrets in prison. And it's funny. It's one of the most respectful places you'll ever be, because you pay attention, you look in the eyes of the person talking to you, and you listen to them, because if you disrespect them, they may kill you. All right. So I'm no dummy. I mean, the first month I basically spent with the correctional staff. And I'd wander around, but, you know, limited my mobility until I kind of was picking out who I wanted to follow or whatever. I mean, I followed the guy who obviously was a sexual predator, had a punk. I followed the guy who was, you know, different from the rest, fed the cats, all this kind of stuff. But I'm out in the prison yard with Carl Bowles. And he turns to me and he goes, you know, you're the safest guy in here. I said, how's that? And he said, well, if something goes down, all of us are going to want to protect you because we want out of here. So we're going to be the good guys protecting the reporter. Mm. Now, that was true, except if you walked in on a crime. I mean, one of the reasons I got out was and stopped doing the research was I got too close to both sides. Mm-hmm. And I was with the correctional officers one time. They said, let's go shoot convicts. And I said, what are you talking about? And he took me out to a firing range, and they had Silverstein's name on a thing, and they're shooting holes in him. Say, do you want to take a shot? Yeah, I mean, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
On the convict side, I was in talking to this guy in his cell, because I can go in their cells. And the music's real loud next door, and he says, hold on a second. And he goes out, and, you know, again, you keep your shank hidden outside your cell. And he goes and disappears. Then he comes back and he's walking by the cell I'm sitting in. He lifts up his shirt and he has a knife in there. And he goes next door and he says, hey, man, I need you to turn down the music. And the guy goes, okay, no problem. He turns it down. And then when the guy comes back, I said, would you have killed him for that? He said, yeah, no tolerance, man, no tolerance. Now, I didn't know how much that would show, but the bottom line was, I went back to my hotel that night and I thought, what if that guy kills somebody with that shank? And I didn't say anything.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like too close to it. But, you know, I get a little frustrated sometimes because I see a lot of wannabes who sell wolf tickets. See a lot of young guys. It doesn't take much to pull a trigger, but still who talk the game and act real tough. And then you run into somebody like Silverstein. And I mean, these guys are for real. Mm-hmm. You do not want them. I mean, one of the members of the Aryan Brotherhood told me once, he said, you know, I don't wait in line at Burger King. He said, I march in. If there's a line there, I said, get out of the way. And he says, that always works. People are scared of me. And if you do run into somebody who isn't scared of you, you have to ask yourself, he has to ask himself, is this worth dying over? Because I will kill you.
Yeah.
And that's, by the same token, I mean, Silverstein, he loved his kids who, you know, I mean, it's that very few, you know, we want evil people to be like Freddy Krueger, all bad and look bad and everything else. And it's, you know, nobody's, with a few exceptions of a couple of serial killers I've met who there's something really off with them. Nobody's all bad, you know, but they are capable of doing very bad things.
Yeah. And that's what I think makes this story so fascinating. Like I said, it's the you get the inside look of the prison system, which you really don't get anywhere else from this point of view and this perspective. And your first book that covered that experience as well. But the development, the mental health, the relationships piece, did anything surprise you more than a decades-long relationship with Silverstein? Is that the most surprising thing that came out of this for you?
Yeah, I ended up 33 years. And, you know, I learned that you can be friends with someone, but you certainly don't approve what they did. And it's interesting because initially, my dad was a minister. And initially, when I met Silverstein, I thought, you know, he's so full of hate and rage. I'm gonna try to lead him to religion and lead him to all this. And he was way ahead of me. I mean, he'd gone down that road. He'd become a Buddhist or everything. But then I soon realized it was the hate that kept him going. And then as he got older and more infamous in the prison, it became his own ego. And that I'm the Norris God. Everybody's afraid of me. But he always thought he was going to get out, too, which is interesting. But I always wondered about religion and how much of it can be a factor in their education. And, you know, again, 85% of the people I met when I was in Leavenworth, they were just guys who'd had a huge amount of them had been abused.
Yeah.
And the correctional system from kitty joints on, you know, reinforced that violence works. And you go into one of these, they call them gladiator schools, you know, the criminal justice system, you put a youth in there and what do? I never thought it worked, and it always made me laugh when they did Scared Straight.
Yeah.
Because most of these guys, convicts are going to yell at you and they're going to change your path. Most of these people in those situations have been yelled at all their life.
Yeah.
That's part of the reason they're in there. No one has showed them love and affection. They've been beaten. They've been sexually abused. And then we put them in this environment where, you know, Lord of the Flies, only the strongest survive. And we go like, oh wow, how'd they end up this way? You know, you look at Silverstein and, he was like a caged animal. And then it just built up with him and until he was ready to strike out. He didn't have a way to, and he had to learn through meditation and through his art. And then he developed connections with letter writing and reaching other people. But, you know, it's Maslow's hierarchy. We want to be safe, but we also want people who care about us and we care about them. And, you know, you don't get that. Prison by its nature is isolating. Mm-hmm. And if you're a fool, if you think, oh, I can go to prison and I can have my girlfriend or my wife visit me or my mother visit me and everything will be fine. Because at the level where Silverstein was, your wife comes and somebody's going to come to you and they're going to say, hey, we saw your wife. She's really good looking. How would you feel if, you know, somebody raped her? Or how would she feel if you end up dead? She needs to start bringing drugs in.
Yeah.
I mean, this is an environment, as I mentioned early on, where you walk in and you nod and you're white, you nod at black inmates, and it's like, oh, you're weak. I can take advantage of you. Mm-hmm. And that's what the predators imprison, the 15%. That's how they think. And that's how Silverstein thought.
Seems like everything was leverage for them to get more right. power and control. And, get
and you know what the driving factor is? They're afraid. It's the attitude, I'm going to do this to them before they do it to me. It's this feeling that, and you see a lot of homophobic, you know, if I don't do this, they're going to bend me over and I'm going to get raped. I'm going to get attacked. I'm going to get beaten. And all those things can happen and they do happen. And Silverstein witnessed them happening. But it's very much driven by fear. And I don't know how you take that fear out of I remember now what I was going to tell you, how you take that out. The first thing they tell a correctional officer is always say no. Why? And this is relevant to Clutch. If a guy comes up to you and says, boss, I need to go to lunch early today because I got something I have to do. You say no. Then you go check on it. And if your lieutenant says it's okay, you go back and say, okay, I talked to lieutenant, you can go. If you say yes, and then you find out the lieutenant says, oh, no way. Then the convict thinks, oh, he was screwing with me. Mm-hmm. He was toying. And then it becomes personal. And the last thing you want to do is step out of, you know, most convicts are going to think you're an awful person if you're a correctional officer. But that's just who you are, mm-hmm. you know. And most correctional officers are going to think you're an awful person because you're a convict. And in fact, the BOP never wants the correctional officer to know what somebody's in for. Mm-hmm. So it's when it becomes personal and you develop some kind of grudge that things get out of hand.
Wow. Pete, again, I'm trying to be cognizant of your time here. Super appreciate you coming on. And this is a fantastic read. And from your perspective of your relationship with Silverstein, but of course, everything that he went through while in No Human Contact and what that meant for him and your observations of it. It's just can't recommend it highly enough. We'll be putting links in the show notes. And if the opportunity ever arises for us to convince you to write another book or to come back on our podcast, we will reach out and do that.
Absolutely. Yep. I'd love to talk to you sometime about mental health.
Yes, but I understand
you're mostly focused on true crime. I appreciate you letting me come on and what you're doing. And I hope John gets better.
All right. Thanks, sir.
Thank you. You take care.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.